How's everybody doing? Welcome back to another episode of The Banker Next Door. I am your host, Dr. Joe Berquist. Today, I'm bringing you another chapter in the review of The Lords of Easy Money. This is episode 8. And what I wanted to do here for just a few minutes is I actually wanted to do a recap of section 1. Good news is that this series has been doing extremely well on the podcast platforms. It kind of took a little while to kind of get going, but people have really kind of gotten into this series and are really loving it. And I'm getting a lot of positive feedback from people on it. So I wanted to create this kind of shorter part today segment. I just wanted to go back over part one, but I also wanted to share with everybody a few articles and a couple insights that I saw. There was an article on CNBC this week that just perfectly nailed the entire conversation that we're having here and why we're talking about this book in such an in-depth fashion and why I'm spending the time to really go into this. So I'm going to share that article with everybody at the end. But first, I just wanted to recap the first six articles here. So I'm going to bring in trusty little PowerPoint slide here. So this is a section one recap. Part one of the book basically covers chapters 1 through 6. And those six chapters are covered in the podcast episodes of the Lords of Easy Money series in episodes 1 through 7. Chapter one was a little bit longer. It actually took me 2 episodes to cover the first 2 episodes of the series to cover chapter one. And then each episode thereafter covers a separate chapter. So, and I wanted to get everybody up to snuff with what was going on here. So what we're going to do here real quick is we're going to do a review of part one. I'm going to do a quick preview of part two of the book. I want to share with you a blog post called The Return to Normalcy, which was written by Emily McCormick over at Bank Director. And then finally, I just want to wrap up with an article called The Wealth of the 1% Just Hit a Record $44 Trillion. And I'm going to share that with you. So first, let's go into a recap. Okay, so what happened in the first 3 chapters of the book? So our main actor, if you will, in the book is a gentleman named Thomas Hawnig, who was a Federal Reserve president of the Kansas City Fed and basically had spent his entire career there working primarily as a bank regulator as he kind of worked his way up the ladder. And Thomas, who became known as a dissenter at the Fed for his no votes, he becomes kind of the primary actor in the most part of this story. So we start out in chapter one, Tom Hawnig, you know, he becomes a dissenter. The Fed basically printed more money in two years than it did in its first 95 years of existence. We get into Ben Bernanke, who basically wants to move full throttle on ZERP, which was zero interest rate policy, and quantitative easing, also known as QE. Then we get into chapter two, where we take a look at, we get a really insight into Tom's background. We really get into his early childhood, his early career, his experience as a bank examiner. We review the history of the Fed, not just the Fed, but we get a kind of very brief taste of the history of central banking in America. We talk about the first bank of the United States, the second bank of the United States, which were the first two central banks in the U.S. And then we get to the founding of the Federal Reserve in 1913. And we basically examine what the Fed did in the 1970s, the actions that they took. And again, this is all just kind of setting the stage here. Then we get into chapter three, and we talk a lot about the inflation in the 1970s. And we talk about a couple of very key things that become the prominent focus of the actions of what happened the rest of the book. And that is we talk about asset bubble. What is an asset bubble? We talk about the two types of inflation, price inflation and asset inflation. And then we get into Paul Volcker. We talk about Paul Volcker's time at the Fed and how he dramatically increased interest rates to defeat inflation, but at the same time caused probably one of the worst recessions in like 81, 82 that the U.S. had seen in a long, long time. But it worked. It worked. And we came out better on the other end of it. We talk about Tom's experience during this period, dealing with a lot of the banks that failed in the 1980s as a result of what happened throughout the 1970s. And then we do a reexamination of the Fed's record in the 1970s, and we look at all of the things that they did. And this is important. It's critical to go back and re-examine that record, because we then begin to see the mistakes that they made. And we also begin to see that the playbook that they use and the playbook that was developed from those times. And we get to see how that playbook back then is basically be the same, almost the same playbook that's being used now. And you see the same mistakes that were made back then being made again, yet again. And it's fascinating. In one of the episodes, I did another podcast episode on inflation, where I literally showed the inflationary charts of the 1970s and basically how we are lining up today with exactly what happened, which was exactly what transpired throughout the 1970s. So if you haven't had a chance to check out that episode, I definitely suggest you go check it out. So, and then we got into something called the cost push and the demand pull inflation, you know, two different types of inflation there, cost push versus demand pull. We talked about the kind of the hard lesson that Tom had learned in the 1970s about what happens when the Fed stokes asset bubbles, when the Fed pushes for asset inflation and inflates the value of real estate and inflates the value of the stock market, and how that cycle always leads to a crash, and then, you know, and then, you know, things get messed up from there. We talked about two of the most well-known and historic bank failures in the history of the United States, and that was Penn Square and Continental Bank. And those are interesting stories. So if you didn't get a chance to definitely go back and listen to those podcast episodes, because you see a lot of themes there. And Continental Bank, that became the founding. That was the first time the words were used, too big to fail. That's where the whole phrase of, oh, this bank has become too big to fail. In other words, if we let this thing go down, it's going to take a lot of other banks with it. So the Continental Bank story, I think in itself, is historic, and it's an interesting story. Then we get into Tom Volcker's end, and we get into Tom's future. So now by this point, it's about 1990. Tom is just taking over now as president of the Kansas City Fed. In 1988, I think it was about 1988, Paul Volcker basically gets forced out at the Fed. You know, the Fed's kind of, you know, Paul Volcker is a very interesting guy, because the more I look back on Paul Volcker, I definitely have a lot of respect for this man, because this man did very courageous things. He took a ridiculous amount of heat for the things that he did. And he was, in a very real way, not willing to toe the party line, so to speak. And so he really got pushed out in favor of Alan Greenspan, a man who was very much willing to toe the party line, but not only to toe the party line, but to obscure the party line in a way that most people couldn't really see exactly what it was that he was doing. So, and then that is a perfect segue into chapters 4 and 5. So what happens here? So in chapter 4, we reviewed the atmosphere at the Fed. We talk about kind of the buildings and the ambiance of what goes on there, you know, how people are kind of moved in and out, the setup of a lot of conference rooms and tables, and how things, you know, work in the Fed, a little bit of the culture there, because that is important to understand. Then we get into the recession of 1990 and what became known as the jobless recovery. We talk about Greenspan's public persona and Fed speak, or what I remember as Greenspeak. The growing divide between monetary and fiscal policy, the lasting effects of the New Deal, what became known as the Fed's escape hatch. In other words, the Fed causes the problem, but then shows up with the solution, and the media lauds them as geniuses for coming up with the solution to the problem that they caused in the first place. So very interesting dynamic there. A lot of that going on right this minute. The Fed's focus on consumer price inflation. In other words, it became a very political thing where the Fed and specifically politicians wanted the Fed to focus on consumer price inflation, because prices going up are not good. Consumers, you're seeing that today. Prices going up are not good. Consumers don't like that. Consumers start to, what do? When prices are going up, politicians start taking a lot of the wrath and a lot of the heat for that, right? So they don't like that. So they told the Fed, you've got to keep the consumer price inflation down. Now, asset price inflation, oh, that's great, because asset price inflation makes everybody feel like they're getting rich. And it feels like the what they call the wealth effect. And we're going to, and I want you to key in on that, because we're going to get back to, I'm going to come back to that at the very end. So people love asset price inflation until the crash happens, but on the ride up, they love it, because then there, it feels like they're making feel like they're, oh, we're getting rich and everything's great. And look at my net worth and all this stuff. Then we talked about the stock market bubble and then the eventual stock market crash of 2000. And that kind of rounded out chapter four. And then we get into chapter five, where we discussed the stoking asset bubbles. And we talked about too low for too long. The Fed kept the interest rates too low for too long in the early 2000s. And then they stoked the asset inflation, which led to the ballooning of the real estate market, which ultimately led to the explosion of the real estate market at the end of 06 and going into 07. Which basically caused the Great Recession there, 07, 08, 09. And then we went into Greenspan's exit. So 2006, Alan Greenspan heads out. Ben Bernanke comes in. He takes the reins at the Fed. Interesting that Greenspan, I always point out, very interesting that Greenspan left in 2006. Right as the data was coming in, that the crap was about to hit the fan. And he nicely exits stage right, because I think he absolutely saw the writing on the wall, and he knew what was coming in after he had been there for 17 years. Alan Greenspan is a brilliant guy, very smart, very brilliant, very talented guy. I think Alan knew exactly what was coming. I think he knew what he had done and what he was responsible for, and he didn't want to be there. He didn't want to be the guy in the middle of that disaster, so he left that for Ben Bernanke. But that's a kind of a different conversation for another day. Then we discussed Tom's three pillars and his speech at the banking symposium, which was a lot of hard truths. He put out a lot. It was a great speech. He put out a lot of hard truths there, but it was also a lot of things that people did not want to hear. So it did not go over well. A lot of people people did not want to hear those hard truths. And then enter Timothy Geithner. So Tim Geithner comes on the scene as the head of the New York Federal Reserve Bank, and then he becomes the Treasury Secretary. So then we get into what happened after the crash of 2008, and then we finish up with Tom's FOMC voting record heading into 2010. So now let's go down to the final chapter here, chapter six. We get to the meeting in 2010, and then Tom's final no vote, his final vote of dissent, which then we talk about kind of the media's coverage of the Fed, and we talk about how Tom's reputation as a dissenter, kind of solidifies in that moment. Even though, again, it's just interesting, because even though you go back and you look at Tom's record and his record of dissent, I think he voted no maybe about 10% of the time. So 90% of the time he voted with Greenspan, or he voted with Bernanke, 90% of the time. So 10% of the time he doesn't go along, but yet that 10% is what he gets killed for. And that's what he gets the hard knock, is the evil dissenter or whatever, So, but anyway, Tom will get his revenge before we get to the end here. Don't worry. Then we get into kind of Bernanke's defense. We talk about how conservatives felt about the Fed's action, about basically, the media always lauds over the Fed, talks about, oh, everybody at the Fed's a genius, and these we owe these people so much because they save us every time from the problems that they create. And, so you get this fawning coverage of the Fed all the time. You can't say negative things about the Fed, and basically how the only real people pushing back on the Fed and their actions were conservatives. And, conservatives were going at the Fed hard, but they weren't really making a lot of traction, because, again, 99% of the coverage in the mainstream media on the Fed is glowing, and they love the Fed and everything's good at the Fed. You can't question the Fed and all that kind of stuff. So and then we get into Bernanke's defense of QE. We talk very in depth about the trading desk at the New York Fed and how the trading desk at the New York Fed, how they move the markets? How do the inner workings there? And that's a great section, and really, really important to kind of understanding to how things work in the market. Then we get into the effects of QE, asset inflation, particularly asset inflation. How did the asset inflation go up? Then we get into the effects of ZIRP, the zero interest rate policy, and the end of what we call the risk-free rate. It's so important to understand this because you understand how the Fed completely turned the market on its head, how it completely turned it all over. And once you understand that, you then begin to understand how if the Fed is going to try to put things back to normal, they're going to cause a equal, if not significant, more amount of damage trying to put it back to the way it was. And all this plays into everything that's happening right now today. That's the interesting thing about all this. Then we get in the search for yield. Because the risk-free rate was not there, if you wanted to make a return on anything, I mean, this punished the poor, it punished savers, it punished retirees who were on a fixed income. It forced everyone to have to go into the market, have to take on riskier projects in order to find any kind of yield that would pay them any kind of return. And that was the whole plan. That was the whole plan of the Fed was to dramatically inflate the assets, to have a dramatic asset inflation and to stoke debt and to stoke people reaching out for riskier and riskier projects that they weren't necessarily getting paid for the risk that they were taking, but they had to do it because they had no other choice. You had to try to make money somehow. Right. And then we get into his retirement from the Fed. We talk about inflating the U.S. monetary base. And then we wrap up with Bernanke's push for more quantitative easing. So that's where basically we leave off there, the first part of the book, the first six chapters. Now let's take a look real quick. So now we get into part two, which is called The Age of ZIRP. And our first chapter there, chapter seven, is going to be quantitative quagmire. And I'll be covering that in the next podcast episode. And then we get into the fixer, the risk machine, the ZIRP regime, the Honig rule. And then we wrap up part two with totally normal. So we're going to be getting a lot more in depth. The first part of the book really covers, again, the focus really is on kind of the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, the 2000s, kind of bringing us up to the financial crisis in 08, 09, 010. And that's really what the first part of the book is. The second part of the book here, this is now going to take us from, 2011 to probably up to about 2016, 2017. And then the final part of the book takes us from 2018 up to about 2021. We kind of get through, we get into COVID a little, just a hair after COVID, and we kind of end on 2021. And that's where we go. But the final part of the book, when we get into the repo market and what happened in September, October, November of 2019 is wild, because you have to understand a little bit about the repo market and how repo market is basically the main liquidity driver. And when we get into that part, I'm going to show you guys some charts and graphs and things that's going to tie this all into what is happening right now today. So, and then again, it'll take, I'm doing these about one a week. So, it'll take probably about another month or so to get there, but we'll get there. Okay. Now I want to go back up for just a second. So now that I want to share two final things with you guys. Okay. So I want to read this. This was a blog post from Emily McCormick, and this is called A Return to Normalcy. And this was written a few months ago, but I was saving this for the right moment. And now I want to bring this out. So I want to read this, this section to you. Like many in the industry, Tom Michaud sees the December decision by the Federal Reserve to pause increases to the federal funds rate as a positive sign. If the Fed achieves a so-called soft landing and eases rates later this year, 2024, banks can look forward to higher earnings, according to the CEO of the investment bank, Keefe, Bruyette, and Woods. But that would take some time. We actually believe in 2024, net interest income for the year will be down because there's not a lot of loan growth. earnings should improve by year end. We think the industry's interest rate exposure and bank balance sheets will have caught up, and that environment could represent a return to normal for the banking industry, Michaud adds. So in other words, they're betting at, so this is go back to January, so they were betting that, okay, the Federal Reserve paused, now interest rates will be cut throughout 2024, and at that point they were pegging in a whole bunch of cuts. And that was going to also be a positive because, the negative bond returns and banks' portfolios on their investment side were going to get better, and things were going to go back into a positive territory. So it was all going to kind of catch up. So a lot of this was basically I think pretty much wishful thinking. But now we get into the crux of it. But that could look different from what the industry has experienced over the years since the 2007-08 financial crisis. In fact, by looking at two key indicators, one could argue that we've been living in abnormal times since that event. And that right there, And that's the exact point of this book, The Lords of Easy Money, is to point out that the Fed turned everything on its head, and we have been living in abnormal times for the last 15 years. That's the point. So the federal funds rate influences the interest rates banks can charge on loans and pay out to depositors. Before the Fed began its series of rate drops to ease the financial crisis, the effective federal funds rate was 5.27%. In the pre-crisis period from 1990 through 2006, the federal funds rate averaged 4.35%. From 2008, when the Fed dropped that rate to effectively zero, until the agency began raising rates in mid-2022, the federal funds rate averaged just 0.51%, spending most of those years hovering just above zero. Today, the Fed funds effective rate exceeds 5%, not too far above the historical average of 4.6%. Likewise, net charge-offs, a measure of asset quality, inched up to 0.5% for the industry as of the third quarter of 2023, from an average 0.46% over the last decade. That average was just a bit higher, 0.73%, in the 16 years before the financial crisis. So Michaud expects to see more credit losses in 2024. The shocker should not be the credit expenses going up, he says. The shocker is it's been zero for so long, that it's been zero for so long. Banks have been setting aside more for expected loan losses, and Michaud says not to count banks out. The banking industry is under a lot of pressure at the moment, but it's not down and out. So right there, you can see the effects in the federal funds rate. Going back before 08, the federal funds rate averaged 4.35%. You know, you had an effective federal funds rate of 5.27% when the financial crisis hit. Now, you know, and then before mid-2022, you had an average rate of just 0.51%, hovering just above zero. And now today, we're getting back to an effective rate that exceeds 5%, which is not too far above the historical average of 4.6. So in other words, you get this moment where the Fed is trying to put things back to normal, but look at all the problems that it's causing in trying to do that. And this, again, this is the point. We're going to see this now in the second part of the book as we start to get into some of the conversations about, did all the Fed governors agree with Bernanke and pushing QE? Not so much. And we're going to see that. But these comments were, the point is, these comments from the Fed governors that didn't necessarily agree, they weren't public. They weren't public in their dissent. They weren't public in their comments. And this is part of the issue of what's going on at the Fed. But you can see that the Fed, they completely turned this market on top of their head. And I thought that that was a great point, pointing out the historical averages on the federal funds rate and also what you've seen in the net charge-off. So, if you follow my weekly banking update, you'll see that I'm going to take this out for a second. You'll see that I'm going to talk a little bit more about, you know, extend and pretend and kind of what's going on there. So check out the banking update for more comments on that. So, okay, I want to switch here I'm going to switch up screens here for just a second because I want to bring in this very key article here. Okay. So this was CNBC, and this was published on last week on March 28th. And this is called "The Wealth of the 1% Just Hit a Record $44 Trillion." So the wealth of the top 1% hit a record $44.6 trillion at the end of the fourth quarter. All the gains came from stock holding thanks to an end-of-year rally. Oh, that's nice. It didn't come from the Federal Reserve stoking the asset inflation bubble. No, it didn't. No, it came from an end-of-the-year rally. But anyway, economists say that the rising stock market is giving an added bonus to consumer spending through what is known as the wealth effect. Oh, I think I said something about that. So, all right. So the wealth effect. Now, this is not the wealth effect of everyone. This is just the wealth effect of the stupid, stinking rich. So the wealth of the top 1% hit this record $44 trillion at the end of the fourth quarter. The total net worth of the top 1% defined by the Fed is those with wealth over $11 million increased by $2 trillion in the fourth quarter alone. All the gains came from their stock holdings. The value of corporate equities and mutual funds shares held by the top 1% surged to $19.7 trillion. The quarter gained marked the largest addition to an unprecedented wealth boom that began in 2020 with the COVID-19 pandemic market surge. Since 2020, the wealth of the top 1% has increased by nearly $15 trillion, or 49%. Middle-class Americans have also seen a rising wealth tide, with the middle 50% to 90% of Americans seeing their wealth increase 50%. Yes, but nothing like the top one. The top one, think about that. Their wealth increased by $15 trillion, 50%. Look at this chart here. For the podcast audiences listening, we're looking at a chart from basically that measures the last 15 years. And this chart right here encompasses, this hits the nail right on the top of the head for this, everything we're talking about in this book. The Federal Reserve has done all of this on purpose. They have increased the wealth of the top 1% on purpose. They have stoked this asset inflation on purpose. This was all to make the wealthy over the last 15 years, to not just make them wealthy, to make them stupid wealthy. And you can understand why they love it. They're loving what's going on. The last 15 years have been the greatest 15 years of their lives. They have never gotten richer. And all of this is being done at the expense of everybody else. The Federal Reserve has created the greatest disparity in wealth in the history of the world. Not just the history of the United States, but the history of the world. There's never been a bigger gap between the people at the top and the people at the bottom. And this is not sustainable. This is absolutely not sustainable. Interesting comment here at the end of this. The author noted that consumer confidence among those making more than $125,000 a year has been in secular decline since 2017. While the bump in stock prices might link to stronger confidence, it doesn't necessarily point to stronger spending at the higher end. Exactly. So in other words, your top 1% certainly, maybe your top 5, 10, 15%, like they're, you know, doing okay right now. 80% of people are not doing good. I mean, you know, if you're making 125 grand a year, that puts you in the top, you know, probably, 40% of income earners in the United States, you know, and you're making, think about that. You're making 125 grand, you're making 150, 200 grand a year, and you're falling behind. That's a pretty darn good living, and you're falling behind. Like that's the problem. And like I said, I just looking at this chart, and that's why I wanted to show this article so bad. It says, and I'll put a link to this article in the description. But yeah, I mean, this thing really just drives the whole thing home right here. And again, if you're in the podcast, I would definitely suggest you go check out the CNBC article and look at this, because this will probably make you sick here if you look at it too long. But anyway, okay, well, let's wrap up. So that was my review of that was my review of part one of the book. Episode 9, we'll come back. We'll kick back off with part 2 and chapter 7. So I hope everybody comes back and checks that out and continues to follow me on this journey as we go through the rest of the Lords of Easy Money. And I hope you will also, if you haven't checked out some of the other episodes of the podcast, please do so. And just remember that we are on YouTube, Rumble, and all major podcast platforms. Please make sure to go check out the bankernextdoor.com. And I will definitely look forward to seeing you all again real soon. So thank you so much.